Good evening, everyone, and welcome to my show, A Fireside Chat. This is your host, Lance White, also known as the Zany Mystic. This is the first night in our new time slot, so if you tuned in to hear Dr. Bell, his new time is going to be Friday at 6 o'clock p.m. I'm delighted to have a wonderful guest who's been on the show with me before, John Hogue. During these times, interest in prophecy is at an all-time high, with Mayan and Hopi prophecy, Edgar Cayce, and others. John is the preeminent authority on Michel de Michel de Nostradamus and the collective prophetic traditions. Hogue's documented predictive track record into the new millennium has achieved an accuracy surpassing 80%. Over the 20-year period, he's written 12 books, with his latest called Nostradamus, The War with Iran, now available as an e-book. So let's get John out here to join us before we all go mad or shift gears into another dimension. Hi, John. Welcome back. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm doing great, Lance.
Well, I am too. You know, I've been reading your latest book, which links the quatrains to the current conflicts in the Middle East. And I have to say, you make a compelling case, and it's very well written, by the way. And I,
you
know, I really like the pictures. I'm a picture person.
So am I.
you've done an excellent job. Before we dive into all of this stuff, maybe you could just give people a snapshot of who Michel de Nostradamus was.
Michel de Nostradamus lived in 1503 and died in 1566 in the French Renaissance. He lived in South France, in Provence. He was a physician and did his prophecy work on the side.
Uh-huh.
And he was born of a Christianized Jewish family, and a lot of Jewish mystical practices were involved in his work, but he seemed to be his doorway to the beyond, to visions of the future, came in an amalgam of different traditions.
Mm-hmm.
I've never actually seen anyone in all my studies of prophetic traditions or prophets through history. I've never seen anybody who took a little of this, a little dab of that, and mix it all together in his own unique bag, as Nostradamus did. I mean, he did a lot of Neoplatonist ritual divination. He also seemed to do things related to the Keys of Solomon, Jewish tradition.
Mm.
He had, there are quotes in his books which show that he had some understanding of Chaldean, Assyrian, and demoniacal magic as well as white magic.
Uh-huh.
Although he constantly publicly denounced black magic. He had to, of course, do many things, cover himself in his writings so that he would not be taken down by the Inquisition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which, when he succeeded in one of his most famous prophecies, and that is the prediction of the current king, Henry II of France, his contemporary, dying in a jousting accident. He made that prophecy in the first volume of his predictions, his history of the future, called Les Prophéties, in the prophecies, and that was in 1555. The event happened in 1559, and the night that the king died, Nostradamus was safely hundreds of miles away in South France when it happened, but a mob of people thronged before the gates of the offices of the Inquisition.
Huh.
And demanded that they burn. They were burning Nostradamus in effigy. They demanded they burn him in literally.
Wow.
So it was one of the things that made him withhold his pen for so long from writing prophecies, because of the harm it might do not only to his near family and to himself, because of people's particular expectations being thwarted. You know, if they were to see how different the future would appear to their their dreamland sensibilities of what religion, politics, and things should be, that if they could see how completely changed things would become, they would damn their own future.
Yeah, yeah.
And he felt responsible for that. So finally, though, when he could see signs that showed France was about to plunge into a religious civil war, not unlike what is brewing in Iraq right now, between Shia and Sunni, between Huguenot and Catholic, French Protestant and Catholic Frenchman in his time. It was because of that looming danger that he decided to write his prophecies and just face the music, whatever that would be.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, in his case, he died in his sleep peacefully in 1566, that is. A relatively well-to-do man and the talk of the courts of Europe.
Hmm. Amazing. During his time, well, actually since then, how many of his quatrains have been considered verified and fulfilled, and what years, how long do they extend out into our future?
Well, the last dated prediction goes nearly 1,800 years ahead of our own time.
In really?
3797, yeah.
Wow.
And that's when the sun is supposed to expand and devour the orbit of Earth.
Wow.
And what's intriguing about that theory, of course, he says that at that time the race, he uses a very strange, he used to make up words that were kind of mixed of other words, and if you have enough knowledge of the Greek roots and the French roots and Latin, you can kind of figure out what it might mean. Because a lot of his prophecies are written in random codes and anagrams.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And kind of a why he called it a wild poetic fever. And he talks about the races, the ethnographies, he calls them, of man will long have since left, and they will live in Aquarius for a while, but they will live in Cancer for time immemorial.
Huh.
And in perpetuity, and the statement, the way he applies the terms Aquarius and Cancer, it's as if he's talking about them as being places, not astrological signs, which means, I presume to say that means star systems in Aquarius, and for a longer time, apparently the colonies in Aquarius don't go over very well or don't last.
Uh-huh.
And go into a dead end, but the ones in Cancer, in the constellation of Cancer, apparently the human race goes on.
Huh.
And reaches some kind of immortality, at least as far as the immortality of the cosmos goes, because they've broken free of just being on one planet.
Hmm. Do his prophecies dovetail at all into the Mayan calendar or into those of Edgar Cayce as well?
Well, they do in as much as they have Nostradamus fixating as much as many others have on the new millennium. But the thing about that, this is a fad that's been around a long, long time in prophecy, and certainly it has gained a renaissance of interest with the year 2000 entering the 21st century. And
mm-hmm.
I like to call it in what you might call in prophecy, Chicken Littleism. And it's basically the idea that on some specific date, doom or the end of man is supposed to happen, or a new age is supposed to begin on a specific date, in a specific calendar, translated into our modern calendar to be December 2012, or as we had one before, May 5th, 2000, or was supposed to see the Earth tilt on its axis about 40 degrees. It didn't.
Mm.
Many people thought the year 2000 or 2001 would be the end of things. Prophecy from the ancient Egyptians and Babylonians said that September 2001 was supposed to be the end of the world. Now, what I, as an interpreter of prophecy, would say is that sometimes you get it right that something important is happening,
mm-hmm.
but But the ego tends to turn vision into a thing of hyperbole anyway. So a lot of times it's exaggerated to what it really would be.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how a number of people pinpointed, a number of traditions pinpointed what would be September 2001 as the end. But it's certainly an end of an age. And who knows, maybe when we look back at how things transpired, the events that happened in September 11th, 2001, may very well be a benchmark, a milestone where we never go back to we're not quite clear what kind of era we're in now.
Mm-hmm.
But it would seem that there's something to it, that some major shift happened, which just so happened to correspond with a beginning of what will probably later be called the Great Third World War of Terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as to really answer your question about 2012,
yeah,
I think that that Nostradamus was not so specific about 2012 as such, because it's really not. It's really not specific to a. You don't go to sleep one night and wake up in a new age. It's just like you don't go to sleep one night and wake up a young man turned into an old man the next day.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the natural span of time and history, just like life, is it's gradual. Although there's certainly some catastrophism to shake things up in that uniformism, and what Nostradamus did do, and as I show in the book Nostradamus, The War with Iran, he seems to be fingering in timeline, points of time, a cluster, using astrological predictions that happen to be about a number of important signs that are taking place right now in the last few years, before the time when a war, the West would prepare a great war on the Near East, and I, in the book, show where there indeed has been plans not only to attack Iraq, but Iran has also been on the agenda of Acts 1 and 2 of a wider program, kind of born by the neoconservative movement that rose into stature after the Cold War, basically took one of America's long-term enemies away. And they were literally writing papers in 1992, of which Dick Cheney, the current vice president, was an editor of the earliest manifestos in 1992. Basically saying, well, we're going to have to, now that the Soviet Union is gone, we're going to have to still remain aggressively involved and engaged and deal with what we feel are the future major enemies for America, because they sit across our oil reserves, our quote-unquote, you know, that they belong to us, that we need them, we know how to use them better than the other big people. And,
right.
And you know, there's a certain truth to all that, and certainly the unstable or dictatorial powers that were running, that are astride all the richest and easiest to drill oil fields in the world, is something, for better or worse, that's going to pull the West into some kind of conflict with those regimes that are over those oil fields. Beyond the right and wrong of it, that is what's happening. And I would say that even though America has got itself stuck in the tar pits of Iraq and may soon jump into a deeper tar pit with Iran, maybe as soon as this coming October, and I'll explain why in a moment.
Okay.
But that if the rest of the world doesn't think they're going to be pulled in, if there's a war with Iran and this thing becomes America versus an unraveling region where all the oil of the world comes, most of it comes from the cheapest parts, when the only stable area of large resources of oil that will be left will be Russia and Venezuela, and when there's a possibility of a economic alliance or boycott of America for doing this, it might see Americans lose 60% of its imports because of this war. Yeah, it's and Europe as well. Everybody disrupted. Yes, everybody's going to get involved, whether they want to or not, in the Middle Eastern problem. Now, there's a very important prophecy that you've probably noticed several times coming up in the book on Iran that talks about a calamitous war under cancer. Now, that is it's quatrain 24 in the sixth volume or century of Nostradamus' prophecies. And in it, it seems to indicate, at least in my mind, that it's a double entendre, which is something Nostradamus loved to do. It's a war under cancer doesn't mean the disease. It's astrological. Well, under cancer means cancer stands for somebody. What country is ruled by the sign of cancer? And what leader of a country simultaneous is ruled by the sign of cancer? America. It is a fact that Mars, which can be the harbinger of new beginnings and new enterprise, is most of the time used, because we mostly use our astrological sources of our cosmic forces in unconscious ways, collectively unconscious ways, is probably a sign for war. So a ruinous war under cancer. Mars is entering cancer a few days after Yom Kippur, which is the 22nd of September. There is, as my book showed, a whole story that's not being told by the mainstream news that shows that the Israeli leadership is being as outrageous in its statements as the Iranian leadership, which is publicized in America.
Right, right.
But what you really have is two sides that are equally saying outrageous things against each other. You then add to that, just recently, a ramp up, a ratcheting up of the apocalyptic rhetoric of our own president when he talks about nuclear holocaust if Iran pursues its atomic aspirations. Well, it's a strange phrase to use, because even if Iran had one bomb, the reality, and even if they were stupid enough to use it against Israel, Israel has at least 500 nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. And I mean, you know, just one crude nuclear device going off in Tel Aviv in 20 minutes, Iran will cease to exist.
Right.
So when the president starts talking about nuclear holocaust in the lingo that's very reminiscent of the vice president's rhetoric, when you know that it's very interesting who has been leaving the White House cabinet of late, or being marginalized. First, I'll begin with the marginalized people. You have Condi Rice, the Secretary of State, who scarcely you ever see anymore.
Right, right.
And Negroponte, who used to run, was the security czar, suddenly left that job to become some undersecretary of Condoleezza Rice. What I noticed is they have one thing in common. They have been consistently against the policy of military options for Iran. Karl Rove has yesterday officially left his job as the president's political advisor, as well as foreign relations. He was also involved in a committee involved in that. He also, it appears, was not very hot on the idea of striking Iran.
Well, that's kind of surprising.
Snow, Tony Snow, is the press secretary. I have a hard time believing what I consider a rather lame excuse that he's leaving because he wants to make more money to put his kids through school.
Well, wasn't he making $168,000 a year?
Yeah, and I'm sure he has stocks and things like that. I mean, it's
that was a I had trouble with that one myself.
And I don't know why he left. I don't think the reason he gives is the reason, but I sometimes wonder, because I think Snow is, I don't always agree with what he has to say, but I think he's very sincere.
Yeah, he seemed that way.
I don't think he wanted to be the man explaining to the American people why we struck Iran.
Yeah.
In October.
Yeah.
Or in the next 6 months.
Yeah. And wasn't it strange that Gonzalez actually caved in? I thought he was going to grit his teeth and hang on like a dog to somebody's leg.
Yeah, it's. I don't know if there's any Iran connection with that, but it may very well be that with what's coming, the White House didn't want to have too many potential scandals to deal with, so just defuse it. You know, best way to, you know, it's old news. If you want to keep dragging in why those prosecutors were fired, it sort of would be politically stupid for the Democrats to continue to dig that up because the man that they wanted to take down is down. So, and there's also some of that involved with the connections with the Valerie Plame conspiracy dealing with Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney's Karl Rove, basically, his political consultant, and the connection they might have had with Karl Rove. It's almost like it might lead to exposing something that's going on with the plan with Iran. And so, you know, a lot of this I go into in my book, Nostradamus, The War with Iran. I basically, the book tries to keep it within the focus of the prophecies of Nostradamus, the fact that he talked a lot about Persia and about what later became Israel and how it was key. And that these dates are lining up for a window in time in the early part of the 21st century where something big is going to happen related to this, and it often has in the metaphors about stars falling from the skies or long comets. Strange thing to call a comet long unless you're trying to explain as a 16th century man the shaft of a regional ballistic missile.
Yes.
With a big fiery tail.
Yep.
Or if you talk about there'll be a comet that falls with a trail of sparks, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And then there's the old double entendre of the fact that we have had in January appearance to the naked eye of one of the most beautiful comets, and certainly one of the brightest in 60 years, Comet McNaught, which became visible the very day that Saddam Hussein was hung.
Oh, really?
And it's to the Nostradamus scholars out there and people who like to play sleuth, prophecy sleuth, they know that for 20 years now I've been saying that Saddam Hussein is the chief candidate for Nostradamus's enigmatic Mabus, M-A-B-U-S, who may be the third Antichrist in his prophecies, the final Antichrist. And, you know, he's supposed to soon die, and then there's a terrible destruction of people and animals after his death. It's actually his death, or the event of his death, is a marker for when the real war starts, unlike the other two antichrists, and it happens when a comet will pass.
Well, there's a comet tonight at 4 something in the morning.
Well, the thing is, there are comets out there all the time.
Right.
And like Comet Neat, I had a lot of letters to hogueprophecy.com, to my bulletins. I write these free bulletins about twice a week. It's kind of a quasi-blog bulletin article, journalistic article about current events and how they relate to prophecy from a agnostic or trans-dogmatic point of view.
Right.
So I embrace all the different prophecies of different religions and rather than one dogmatic line.
Exactly.
And and anybody can join Hogue Prophecy Bulletins by just going to my website and clicking on, and you get these notices to look at these articles. And
I love receiving them.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Well, Comet Neat, I had to do something on Comet Neat, and you can read it in the archives at hogueprophecy.com. And it's important to read because in it I try to explain to people that what often happens to people trying to understand where Nostradamus is coming from is that we try to understand him from our own understanding. we assume he thinks like us. We don't consciously do this, but you often catch yourself in the act of doing it. You know, when we see some neat, interesting, excuse the pun, some interesting comet, and we're talking all about it, and we're seeing it in our binoculars and our telescopes, we forget that Nostradamus, being a 16th century man, would only be interested in comets that you see with a naked eye.
Right.
That are huge, that are, you know, significant, like Comet Halley or the Comet of 1812 or Comet McNaught. Or Hale Bopp was the last candidate in 1997. But this one coming early this year and becoming visible early this year was absolutely spectacular in the southern hemisphere, sending off this aurora-like rooster tail that went out millions of miles into space. It's one of the most beautiful people. If you want to go and search pictures of it, it's really one of the prettiest comets I've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
So it's very significant, and the fact that it happened to appear to the naked eye when the chief candidate for 20 years for Mobbus was hung is significant in prophecy. And so now we wait to see that in this year or next year if some huge escalation in conflicts begins. And it would seem that we're kind of heading towards that.
Well, now, who are the people behind this neocon agenda? And you mentioned PNAC, and then there's NAFTA as well, which is running under the radar, and it's set to start up, I think, about September 1st, Labor Day weekend, that they're going to start trucking things from Mexico.
Well, you know, back in 1994, I wrote an essay in my book, The Millennium Book of Prophecy, where I looked at collective prophecies. The first half of the book was about doomsday, and then I contradicted all those visions with visions of bloomsday. and offered, challenged the reader to realize that you seize which timeline of the future, you give birth to it with your actions, and the only time that really matters, that really exists, the eternity of the present.
I like that.
And one is empowered to do something individually and collectively in the eternity of the present.
Wow.
So, with that said, there was a lot of indications that in an essay I called it, "There's a Dark Side to Aquarius," the Aquarian Age. You know, during the early 90s, it seems like everybody saw it as a panacea for all good things that are going to happen. We just had to kind of look the other way, hide out, not change, not do anything, and wait for some phenomenal new age to, you know, spike the atmosphere in days of the comet of H.G. Wells, and suddenly everybody snaps out of it, and we're all living in space alien dolphin heaven, you know.
Or for the Christians, it would be the rapture.
Yeah, and it's really the same kind of idiocy in another more New Age guise.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wanted to caution people is the Aquarian Age is much more than that. It has its positive sides and it has its dark challenges as well.
Wow.
And the idea of mass mind control. Aquarius rules the atmosphere, so the main source of change in the world, for better or worse, is in the atmosphere of the electric, even electromagnetic, microwavic. You know, it is about the Aquarian Age is about you with your cell phone up against your head. You know, it's about you. If there really is an Antichrist, at least the way I see the Antichrist, he's not going to be some heroically insane fellow with a funny armband and a mustache. He's not going to be something that would give awe and inspiration to somebody who lived 2,000 years ago. He's going to be a guy who plays with ones and zeros. He's going to be somebody who doesn't control the world through politics, but he controls the world of information. And not only the world of information, but he if he's an ego personified,
mm-hmm.
he's going to be trying to change the way you view information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He will condition you
mm-hmm.
to have a short-term memory. He will condition you to be from a saver of your wealth to a consumer.
Mm-hmm.
He will convince you to go buy a house that you can't afford.
Yeah.
So that then you're ad hoc and under his power.
Uh-huh.
And the fact ultimately is he's not even a person. He is a force in all of us.
Yeah.
It's unconsciousness. And, you know, the human race is this unique first animal on the planet that has enough sentience to actually break from the collective evolution to individual transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, once this happens, the forces of the big machine that runs this country, Gaia, I mean, runs the world, this huge organism, which is constantly mechanically trying to find balance, and if something goes out of whack, it eradicates it through natural means, through plagues, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the human race is somewhere caught in the machinery, and its consciousness is an anomaly to the unconscious machine of the Earth and the Earth system, the Earth body mind, if you like.
Uh-huh.
And it's not a question of right or wrong. It simply eradicates all those things that are anomalies. Because they compute mindlessly to imbalance.
That sounds quite a bit like the Matrix.
Well, yes, actually, there are a handful of movies throughout cinema history that I consider works of prophecy, and I will eventually comment, and give my two cents on movie reviews from a prophetic angle, and list some of the movies that actually will be looked back upon as not just entertainment, but actually works of visionary prophecy. And actually, the Wachowski brothers have come up with two movies, a trilogy plus V is for
V
Vengeance.
V for Vendetta.
Or Vendetta.
Yeah.
V is for Vendetta. and these are works of prophetic cinema.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with that one.
You know, in a similar way, François Truffaut's adaptation of Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451
mm-hmm.
Has more to do with our kind of, you know, the whole George Orwell concept of 1984, kind of like Stalin run amok and taking over the world, was something you could understand at the opening stages of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Bradbury's book captured something more close to the more subtle danger is you will have this completely affluent consumerist society that's staring in front of wall-sized TVs, like flat-screen TVs,
mm-hmm.
and they've lost their souls into this, and they don't even know anymore. They've become so fundamentally phony that they don't even know how to feel anymore
mm-hmm.
or know
mm-hmm.
things or even... And here's through he uses the medium of books, and you know in those days they're so advanced and affluent that the houses don't burn anymore. So a fireman is now not a person who puts out fires in houses, but he burns books
mm-hmm.
because books are considered antisocial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's also a society completely short-term memory lost. Into its entertainment, completely distracted, that's about to fight a nuclear war, and it doesn't even seem to know or care.
Mm.
And in the book, actually, unlike the movie, the nuclear war happens. But in the movie, François Truffaut changed it. And I know Ray Bradbury. He was one of my first mentors. I met him once. And he even read one of my first stories and helped me, and he's just a wonderful man and very inspiring to young writers. And I remember him telling me that Truffaut and him used to be on the phone. This was before Bradbury could speak fluent French, and Truffaut didn't speak English, and they were trying to express, they couldn't really understand each other's languages, so they had to kind of somehow do it from the heart. And Truffaut then, in that in that realm, wrote this beautiful adaptation with Oscar Werner and Julie Christie, and then it was one of Bernard Herrmann's last, most haunting scores. I mean, he used to do a lot of Albert Hitchcock, and of course, one of my favorites was The Ghost in Mrs. Muir.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
He did the music for that.
Well, what about Bradbury's Illustrated Man?
Well, you know, Ray didn't like that at all, what they did to it. He was pretty... He said, I just stepped back and let the whole thing collapse in a heap. I kind of like what Rod Steiger did. I'm a big Rod Steiger fan. So.
I like that movie. I'm sorry.
Ever since I saw him in Dr. Zhivago, when I was a kid, and then I couldn't get enough of Rod Steiger wherever. And then I thought he did a fantastic Napoleon in Waterloo.
Yeah,
Russian-Italian production from the same guy who did the amazing battle sequences in the Russian version of War and Peace, which is probably the last movie in history that will have that many extras in one shot. 120,000. Three divisions of the Soviet Union all dressed up in Napoleonic garb.
Wow.
Anyway, we're going all over the place tonight.
No, that's all right.
But I don't think anybody minds.
We can do that.
Yeah. Who says we can't? This is the freedom of the information revolution.
Exactly.
The watercourse way.
Exactly. I think it makes things interesting. You know, in fact, I was trying to find out a way to segue into your experiences, your spiritual experiences with Rajneesh or Osho, and I couldn't figure out how I was going to do that, so now you've opened the door.
Well, Osho loved Dr. Zhivago very much.
He did.
And he liked the Russian version of War and Peace. In fact, before Osho left his body, he saw Dr. Zhivago three times.
Really?
Yeah, he loved that film.
What can you tell us about him? He's such an enigma, you know, with his Rolls Royces, and I think he's brilliant myself. I mean, you just can't write 50,000 spiritual books in such depth without being an awakened conscious being.
Yeah, he never actually wrote a book. He spoke off the cuff, spontaneously, but it all came out like he had taken hours to write it. And the tally is around over 700 books.
Good night.
And half of them are still in Hindi.
Wow.
But he used to do a discourse for a time in the late 70s, early 80s. He would do every other discourse would be in Hindi and in English, Hindi and English. And his grasp of English was masterful, but it's also remarkable to hear him speak in Hindi, his mother tongue, because it's such a poetic language. And I'm told from the Indian disciples that whenever he would start telling stories, he would always capture the dialect of whoever was, you know, what caste or what corner of India, and that alone used to make them just crack up. He was very funny, and you might call Osho the Jack Benny of gurus. He had this very dry, straight-faced way of saying things that were very funny. You know, one of the funnier ones that I recall was, that pulled me to him more than it when I was seeking proof. I had been an opera singer, groomed to be an opera singer. Everybody thought I was going to have quite a great career. I was kind of what you would call in opera a child prodigy, which is an 18-year-old. It's an older man's sport. That's like being a child in opera, 18 or 20.
Yeah.
And I was like doing Madame Butterfly as a lead baritone at 21, and I was trying to play 45, and the 45-year-old soprano was trying to play 15, you know. I had an easier time of it with makeup. But I was pulled into that, and then I realized that I loved to sing, but I didn't like the politics, and I also felt like I was being pulled to something more solitary in my creative life and just more in. And so I left, suddenly just left, and rather shattering breakthrough in the process. I was just 21, and I then began to search. I was compelled to search and devour whatever I could to understand, and I suppose what I did in about 3-4 years is find a real masterful way to paint a picture of rice cakes.
Hmm.
Which means that I think many of the people listening out there can understand that there's a I would even say one of the best examples of a picture of a rice cake is this current fad with What the Bleep Do I Know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, all wonderful stuff. You know, just a wonderful way of expressing all kinds of amazing mystical truths, but completely in the head.
Yeah.
It is not a, look, I can describe to you, or I can even paint for you, the most beautiful painting you'll ever see of water. It might even be more beautiful than what actual water looks like. But a person like Osho, he might draw you in through his words, but if you get close enough, this is the kind of guy that will grab you by the collar and throw you in the water.
Huh.
Won't talk about it anymore. You have to swim in it. You have to feel its wetness. You have to feel drown in it. You have to flow with it. And suddenly the whole issue of making a pretty word out of this experience called water is just like, you can look back at that and say, that's kindergarten stuff. I mean, that's like, if that can satisfy the spiritually minded intellectual.
Mm.
But if you really have reached the point where What the Bleep Do I Know is not just a nice, cute, intellectual statement, but an absolute shattering from your head to your toe, that I really don't know.
Hmm.
You know, I don't know who I am. I don't know what this world's about.
Mm-hmm.
Got a whole lot of people telling me this and that, but in the deep interiority of my being, I feel this shattering of it. Is not any of it is really telling the truth or knows.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a real alone, crisis-filled space to be in. It's an existential crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when that happens to someone, that's when the search really begins. And if, you know, there's the old statement that says that you don't actually seek a master seeks you.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that, and each individual has to experience this. I can tell you this story, and it's a nice story, but unless it happens to you, you don't know if what I'm saying is true or not.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went through this process of disseminating all this stuff, the day that it dawned on me that I answered all the fundamental questions that I'd been seeking, rather than have a breakthrough, it was almost like a breakdown.
Mm.
So suddenly this feeling of, I feel so completely dead and phony.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got this picture of a rice cake, but I'm trying to eat it and it doesn't nourish me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the most beautiful. It's using the Zen term, you know, people who make pictures of rice cakes. A lot of people who are into spiritual mumbo jumbo or into intellectual spiritual candy games.
Right, right.
It, at a certain point, I mean, that's all cool. We all do it. It's great. But at a certain point, you go, I'm tired of eating this paper picture of rice cakes.
Mm-hmm.
I want the real rice cake.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, then often what happens is that you end up, the master calls you.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean he's saying, hello, John, are you there? It's much more subtle than that. But basically what happened was that I was pulled like a magnet to India.
Huh.
I knew that I couldn't go any further in this work with my own understanding of things.
Right.
I saw that my understanding was no understanding.
Right.
I had at least that much understanding. So that seemed to lead me into, you know, I stumbled across Osho's picture and his book called Only One Sky.
Huh.
And I thought, what an amazing phrase, only one sky. That just hit me. It might not hit anybody the same way,
uh-huh.
but it hit me. And then I wanted to find this fellow, and I felt like he was actually calling me to come be with him. So
uh-huh.
I went. And I went at a time when a lot of people were still getting over Jonestown.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole thing, oh, cults and cult gurus and all of that. Tell me any real guru in his contemporary times that isn't called by the mainstream religions and political establishments a cult guru.
Well,
you know, I'm thinking there's that cult leader from Galilee called Yeshua that later people twisted into a phony name called Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
There was that guy who said all Brahmin, that anybody could be a Brahmin, which was a complete heresy in Hinduism. You know, the guy that everybody was expecting to bring back fundamentalist Hinduism, he was even foreseen 1,000 years before he came to be born in Bihar
mm-hmm.
as the next avatar of Hinduism, ends up throwing Hinduism on its ear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cult guru, Gautama Buddha, that was, you know, if you look at the history of mystics, certainly it's dangerous to go seek a master because you might run into a Jim Jones.
It's
dangerous.
That's exactly what happened to me. I read Meetings with Remarkable Men by George Gurdjieff, and then I read some of Uspensky, and I just had to find an esoteric school.
Yep.
And I ended up in a cult in Northern California in an esoteric school called the Fellowship of Friends. And, you know, I don't regret it, but there are people that are still in that school today and making that person, they're quite wealthy. So, well, let's go back to Osho. What,
mm-hmm.
Did you go to India then to be with Osho?
Yeah, I went to meet him and take discipleship
wow.
in 1980.
Wow.
And it was when he was still actually personally giving disciplehood. Of course, one of his statements it was that, in the old days, you had to wait like 20, 30 years for it to happen. He said, look, I just give it to you and then so that you can relax and then it will happen later. So in all accuracy, I can't say that I've had the initiation yet. But... you know, Osho was kind of trying to break from the past, the entire past.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that he did that was to, I don't know if there's ever been a mystic that has commented on every angle of the spiritual search. I mean, he had books on Hasidism, Sufism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he even dealt with Blavatsky and her people as
yeah.
well as all the Zen masters. All the Hindu masters,
yep.
Buddhist, his Dhammapada series,
yep.
which he took a whole year to do, is remarkable on Buddha, a very unusual take on Buddha, which, you know, one of my favorite takes that he had about Buddha is how the Buddhists are fundamentally seeing it upside down, that if they really want to become Buddhas, they should do what Gautama Siddhartha did, as they should live life totally, hedonistically, grab the brass ring, get all the things that you think are going to make your life full, and then you might, at a certain point, if you have a certain spiritual intelligence, suddenly look at your life and say, and run off into the forest, just like he did, you know, just like, well, I don't feel any more fulfilled with all this stuff. Because, you know, that's the story of Prince Siddhartha. His father was given him to... an astrologer predicted two possibilities for Siddhartha, that he'd become a great world conqueror like Alexander the Great, or he would conquer himself and become a great mystic.
Wow.
A world teacher. Father, who was a warrior class, Kshatriyan, just like Buddha wanted his son to be a warrior. So the story goes that he kept him in specific palaces for the summer and the spring and that he never really got to see people getting old. He always lived in luxury, had lots of women, wine, women, and song.
Mm.
And at a certain point, he did see somebody getting old, and he then saw somebody who died, and then he realized that he'd been, this whole huge illusion had been created for him, and he asked this chariot driver who was taking him to this youth festival, and apparently was pulled off the road and saw things that he wasn't supposed to see, like an old people, because usually whenever Buddha came into town, all the old people had to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw this old man. He said, what happened to this man? He said, oh, that's old age, Lord. And he said, that's what happens to all of us. And then he saw a body being taken to the ghats, to burning ghats to be burned. And he said, and that's where we all go to. But then he saw a man in orange, a saint, and a sannyasin, a disciple of somebody. And he said, who's that? Well, he's trying to seek a truth beyond all of this, see if there's something that divides all of this. And Buddha realized that he had to do that and realized his whole life was illusions, and then went off 6 years into the forest. And the point being that Osho is trying to point out that, you know, the way it started now, and the Buddhist priests do the 6 years of solitude and asceticism and try to suppress all the other things, and that is, that's not what Buddha did, so why is the Buddhist religion following the opposite of what Buddha did?
Right, right.
So, I mean, he came up with a concept. I mean, one of the things in a prophetic angle that is as significant about Osho in the topic of prophecy is that he like Gurdjieff and Uspensky and Aurobindo and a few other 20th century mystics, Krishnamurti, were all shared a vision of a new humanity that will have to come to balance the situation that we have now with a humanity that's kind of crystallized in its old habits to a point where it might self-destruct and take the world with it in many various ways. And certainly that has been in prophetic literature since the first prophet saw our future thousands of years ago. And what I think people like Osho did was give a much clearer understanding of what exactly this new man, this new humanity could be like, and how we actually give birth to that new humanity by living in the eternity of the present, because that humanity in the future does the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's a bridge to this utopia, it is completely in our power to awaken that new humanity in ourselves, and in something I call kind of a, you know, another kind of revolutionary provocation, if you will. It's a path that I try to follow and understand, and that is, and it's been through the grace of meditating and learning Osho's techniques of meditation that I've come to understand that, you know, we usually see things in our world, I would pose to you, upside down from the way they really are.
Yep. Yep.
And one of the things that we constantly do is, to give you an example, is if you love me, I'll be happy. You know, if I'm rich, I will be fulfilled. If I get my dreams fulfilled, then I will be fulfilled. But here's the radical turnaround that I propose to your audience. What if you just simply were fulfilled without a reason? No reason whatsoever. In fact, in the face of a million reasons not to feel fulfilled. Now, you know, what if you simply became the love you're seeking through the arms of other friends and other people and the respect and the attention of others? What if you became free of that bondage and simply were the love that you can't have unless some people give it to you or things get better or you're happier? What if you just said no to all that and just simply were available to being love and fulfillment of love without any effect? I mean, or cause. It would be, if I call it effectless, or cause, rather than cause and effect, it's just effect without a cause.
Well, this sounds remarkably similar to Werner Erhard's S trainings.
Yes, except that that's a picture of a rice cake of what I'm saying. Just like The Secret.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Nice picture of a rice cake. And so affordable, too.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to change a thing. You know, it's, and I predict in 2 years it'll be forgotten and some new rice cake.
Oh, yeah.
In pictures.
New, better, and different.
Yeah. In fact, so, you know, to a a majority of people, that's fine for them. But if you are a real seeker of something, that you're ready to, it's a life and death situation.
Yeah.
You have to find out. Because it's like this, I mean, you just have to find out. You have to find out who you are and what it all is. And it's like you're ready to go all the way. And, you know, a lot of people who buy into these things are not ready yet. They have not gotten fed up enough with the way things are and the way they're themselves are. And that's what I love about the cinema metaphor of Neo in The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
The Matrix is a cinematic science fiction construct that is really a metaphor for our lives. We are living in the Matrix called robotic unconscious behavior,
mm-hmm.
programmed by a society that just so happened, and nobody decided it really. No intelligent person would have decided to make it the way it is. It just sort of fell into place,
mm-hmm.
that every child that's born is imprinted with seeds of the misery field of this world that keeps history repeating itself, keeps people just mindlessly borrowing knowledge or identities from others. For instance, mm-hmm. you know, if what happened to Jesus Christ happened to Jesus Christ, that's wonderful. But some guy or gal in a dress or in a religious garb as a person of authority imparting that to you, when clearly that woman or that man doing it, those priests or priestesses have not had the same experience,
mm-hmm.
have no authority to dispense the grace that fell on Jesus in his baptism with John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you could at least take that if it happened to someone like Jesus, it could happen to me if I go into my own 40 days into the wilderness,
mm-hmm.
wherever that wilderness might be, and see myself like Jesus did.
Mm-hmm.
That's at least what I take from it. It you know, whether Jesus was enlightened or not, he's not right in front of us right now doing this. Only in the imagination of people that talk to higher fathers like the President of the United States. But, you know, the reality is, and then another reality may very well be that if God really can do wonders on this earth, it may very well be that he needs our eyes unblemished, our hearts unclosed, our minds unobsessed, and it may very well be that if our hand is not free to do God's work, then God's work doesn't happen here. If our minds are not free to think intelligently, then God is as stupid as we are. And, you know, rather than put it on an imaginary friend outside of oneself, I think one of the fundamental mistakes all religions seem to teach is that we always seek we turn our own godliness into an imaginary friend that we pray to.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we certainly have gone, we haven't quite gone full circle, but we've certainly come close to it, and we're almost out of time. Well, we could certainly talk for hours and hours and hours. You're just one of the most fascinating people to talk to, and I just love it because you have such a refreshingly unique perspective on things. And don't you feel that people are awakening today, though, more than how they have in the past? I mean, we're in a materialistic society, and don't you feel that people are beginning to search for something more?
I think, you know, one of the theories that's been bounced around is that at any one time, the human population has 5% of its numbers that have the potential to become fully Christ or Buddha conscious. So that not all of them get a chance, not all of them live in a climate or a country or a place where that can happen. But that is, if that's the case, then more people have the potential to become a Buddha now than lived in many thousands of years.
I hadn't thought of that. That's a good
one. So the other thing, too, is Gurdjieff used to say, often people used to say to, oh, what a shame, George Ivanovich, you tried to set up a school in Moscow, and then World War One happened, and then you tried to rebuild it again, and then the Bolshevik Revolution happened, then you tried to go to Paris, and then the Nazis occupied it. And it seems like every time you tried to start something, it got stuck, or didn't really grow into some huge thing. And his common response to that was, no, you misunderstand. You misunderstand my work. You know, I need a crisis in the world, because this is when people who have the potential to look at themselves are shocked into doing so.
Wow.
If everything is going Ozzie and Harriet Nelson-like,
yeah.
If it's all a Walt going to Disneyland, Disney fantasy world, and everybody's happy, everybody falls asleep. Look at the 90s. Look at the Clinton bubble.
Mm-hmm.
It was a slumber time. And now, things aren't so comfortable. In fact, they're going to get a lot more uncomfortable in a very short future. But I side with Gurdjieff on that. If we're entering some very dire times, it is for those who want to find out who they are, who want to be that mystery that passes, I can't say it, that's beyond understanding,
right?
That's, if you want to live in the eternity of the present, that means you have to drop the all the other stuff, and what better time than when dreams are dashed and when great icons are crashed?
Well, I'm going to segue into having you tell people how they can get onto your site and find out more about this.
Yes, my site is called HogueProphecy.com. That's like, Hogue is spelled like rogue with an H. HogueProphecy.com.
Wonderful.
All one word.
Wonderful. John, you've been absolutely wonderful tonight, and I want to have you back again, because I'm just, you know, it's just starting to get interesting and we have to stop. Thank you so much for being on tonight.
You're welcome. And remember what the great vaudevillian said, leave them wanting.
Well, thanks again, and good night, everybody. This has been another episode of A Fireside Chat with John Hogue, and we'll be back next week, same time, same place. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, John.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Good night.